Yes, I got the snake, and then we'll...
The snake?
The snake.
Yeah, I think I heard it first.
Bowing in the Amida has another important connotation. Amida is another word for the Shemona Esrei. Okay, bowing in the Amida has another important connotation. The Talmud states that one of the reasons why the Amida has 18 blessings is that they parallel the 18th vertebrae of the spine and neck. The 19th blessing, which was added later, parallels the coccyx.
The
C-O-C-C-Y-X. The small bone at the base of the spine. This brings to mind the concept of kundalini energy that is discussed in Eastern teachings. This is not to suggest that there is any relationship between the Jewish teaching and that of the East, but merely to point out that the spine is universally recognized as an important conduit of energy. Moreover, whereas in Kundalini meditation one strives to elevate energy from the base of the spine to the head, in the Amida one brings energy from the mind to the rest of the body. The Talmud also teaches that if one does not bow in the blessing of thanksgiving, that's smogin, one's spine turns into a snake. Obviously, this is not to be taken in a physical sense, but in a spiritual meaning. One reason the Talmud gives for the number of blessings corresponding to the number of vertebrae is that one must bow low enough for each vertebra to be separated from the one next to it. The Talmud also teaches that when one bows, one should do so like a rod, like we demonstrated yesterday, like that, straight down. But when one rises, one should do so like a serpent, raising the head first and then the body, which we demonstrated yesterday, means like that. The kundalini energy is also seen as taking up the form of a serpent. In Jewish tradition, however, the serpent is seen as the enemy of mankind. The serpent is the tempter who tries to use sexual energy to draw humans away from God. The Talmud therefore teaches that if one does not bow during Amida, then one's spine turns into a snake. In contrast, the posture in kundalini meditation requires the spine to be kept perfectly straight and erect. If a person worships in this manner without bowing, then his spine will become infused with the kundalini energy, which is the serpent. Bowing may be a way of overcoming this energy of the serpent. The concept of kundalini is to bring energy up from the sexual area to the rest of the body. Bowing has the opposite connotation, namely that of bringing energy down from the head to the body. Therefore, when we bow, we lower the head towards the body. Only after we have bowed and infused the body with spiritual energy can we rise and lift energy from the spine to the head, rising like a snake. In this manner, the Amida is designed to bring spiritual energy through the spine to the entire body. This is also the reason why this prayer is said with the feet together. As I have said, this is the stance in which angels are visualized by the prophets. During the Amida, one strives to bring oneself into an angelic mode, when the spiritual becomes dominant over the physical. That's what I mentioned most of this yesterday, so I didn't realize that in the Eastern tradition you stand straight up. I thought they had a different way of bowing. Rather, the idea is to stand straight up, so the energy flows on different schools.
Look, but it's not that simply, he's describing one aspect of how this whole these systems work. The presumption is that one cycles the energy through one's body and not simply rises from one dark, evil, terrible place to another nice, high place and changing the nature of things. I mean, it's a cycling of something, and they're describing not two different sides, but two different portions of the cycle. It's like describing the water cycle. Like saying the rain is the fog versus the rain falling.
I want to, by the way, to tell you before we go on, that this book, Jewish Meditation, was its first draft. This is the first draft of Jewish Meditation. The reason why it is the first draft is he completed the manuscript the day before he died. And therefore it is not edited and not footnoted.
Yeah, I heard that my rabbi told me that the night before he went to sleep that night or something, he told his wife, I think as they finished, he's like, I feel like I've completed what I meant to do. And he died that night.
I think he died in the mikveh.
Yeah, I haven't heard anyone
say he died in the mikveh.
Or maybe he, like, it was the night before he died. I heard, like,
whatever. Whatever the case may be, it's very spooky.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I have a question. So, like, I don't know, this might be a stupid question, but, like, since the queen is being whatever, they believe that, like, you're pulling sexual energy away from doing the opposite, that means when we do this balancing, we're, like, bringing more sexual energy to ourselves?
We're saying that it means the opposite.
Trying to
we're trying to bring the head down to the body. Bring the head closer to the body in order to bring down the power of the head down to the body. That's what she's possessing. Okay, now Alex is going to do a demonstration for us today, okay, about visualization. But before we get there, because he does, he taught me yesterday.
I can put my resume, I thought it was
tomorrow we're doing pottery.
Before we talk about visualization, yesterday, and I told you it's very difficult, but he actually demonstrated to me that this is not so difficult as one might think. But I'm going to read you what he says. It's going to take about 10 minutes to read it slowly, about 5 pages, and then we will give the floor over to Alex. Okay, you ready, guys? Earlier, I spoke about the images that one sees. By the way, one thing I should mention, actually, because you asked me yesterday, he says there's two options of what to visualize during Shemona Esrei. One is to visualize the name of God, Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, and the other is to visualize the words that you're saying as you're saying them. To take, you know, the words of the Shemona Esrei and visualize them in your mind as you're saying them.
What if you have trouble spelling?
It's good in English. What difference does it make? You're not the same way. Yeah. You get the idea. Okay. You should, if you that that's the case, you should try and implant a spell check in your mind.
You don't come up as a runner.
If you want to do practical help, too, don't give us the help.
Okay, see? Okay. Earlier, I spoke about the image that one sees when the eyes are closed. Now, what Alex told me yesterday is that, well, you'll see when you see that. An important discipline of meditation is learning how to control these images. When one has learned how to control them, one can learn how to hold an image in the mind's eye. This technique is known as visualization. A simple way to begin this discipline is to close your eyes and try to picture a letter of the alphabet, for example, the letter A. If you know the Hebrew alphabet, you can try to visualize the letter Aleph. Since there are Jewish meditations that use the letter Aleph, I shall use it as an example, although any other letter or figure could also be used. To begin a visualization meditation, close with respect to Rabbi Kaplan, Alex does a better explanation. To begin a visualization meditation, just close your eyes and relax, allowing the images in the mind's eye to settle down. If you have been practicing mantra meditation, you may want to use it as a relaxing mechanism. In any case, after a few minutes, the images in the visual field will become easier to control. When the visual field is fairly calm, you can begin to try to visualize the olive. You may have an olive printed on a card and set the image of it in your mind. Then close your eyes and try to picture the olive. Try to see it with your eyes closed, exactly as you saw it with your eyes open. At first, this may be extremely difficult. The images that you see in your mind's eye are very difficult to control. If you have various names of God, if you have never done this before, it'll be almost impossible the first time. One important aid of visualization is the name of the object to be visualized. If you're trying to visualize the Aleph, you may repeat the word Aleph to yourself periodically. You may even wish to repeat the word over and over, as if it is a mantra. This not only relaxes the visual field, but locks the mind on the Aleph. Repeating the word Aleph as a mantra will bring the letter into mind's eye. Another good aid to initiate the visualization exercise is contemplation meditation. If you wish to visualize the Aleph, first spend several days contemplating the letter written on a card approximately 20 minutes a day. This will serve to fix the image in the mind. It will then be much easier to fix the Aleph in the visual field with the eyes closed. If you still encounter difficulty, the meditation session can be split between contemplation and visualization. Spend the first 15 minutes of the half-hour session contemplating the Aleph, looking at it with your eyes open. Then during the next 15 minutes, you can try to visualize it with the eyes closed. The ability to do this exercise varies from individual to individual. Some are able to do it the first time, while others have to do to work for weeks before they can visualize the letter. Alex will show you that you can do it in 10 seconds. With patience and perseverance, however, it can be done by almost anyone. Even after depicting the letter in the mind's eye, the average person will be able to hold the image only for several seconds. Then, like all such images, it will dissolve into other images. With time and practice, one eventually develops the ability to hold the image clearly and firmly in the mind's eye for extended periods. When this is accomplished, one has come a long way in gaining control over the mental processes. The ability to hold an image in the mind's eye is discussed at length in the Kabbalah text dealing with meditation. Thus, the Sefer Yetzirah refers to two processes in depicting the letters. Engraving, Chakika, and Ewing, that's H-E-W-I-N-G, Chativa. Both processes are seen as important if one is going to depict the letters. As discussed in the previous chapter, the Hebrew letters are seen as channels of the forces of creation, and as such they can be used as a powerful means of drawing down spiritual energy. However, engraving and Ewing are useful also for less esoteric forms of meditation. The term engraving denotes fixing an image in the mind's eye so it does that it does not waver or move. No matter what other images may arise in the field of vision, the engraved image remains there, as if the image were actually engraved in the mind. Once a person has accomplished this, he can usually depict the desired image as soon as he begins meditation, almost as a reflex. However, even when the image is clear and steady, engraved in the mind, as it were, it is usually surrounded by other images. The next step is to isolate the image. Thus, for example, if one were visualizing the letter Aleph, one would attempt to isolate it and rid the mind's eye of all other imagery. This is known as Ewing or Chativa. The analogy is to Ewing out a stone from the surrounding rock. The process consists in designating the desired stone and then Ewing away all the extraneous stone. One does the same thing in the mind, Ewing away all extraneous imagery surrounding the desired form. All that is left is the image one desires. There are a number of ways of viewing away surrounding imagery. One way is to replace all the mental images other than the Aleph with pure white. First, focus on the Aleph, allowing it to fill the mind. Then gradually, view away the images around the Aleph, replacing them with white fire. I thought it was white fire and black fire. It's black fire, white fire. Imagine
black on white.
It's black on white.
Like it's a little red.
Yeah. Okay. Imagine the white fire burning.
That's why I had trouble. I knew it wasn't me on purpose.
Imagine the white fire burning away the other images. Begin with a small spot of white fire at the top of the Aleph, using it to burn away a small spot of imagery. Let the white fire expand, burning away larger and larger areas. As it moves around the Aleph, burning away images on all sides. Finally, one sees the Aleph alone, written in black fire on white fire. In general, a visualization technique such as this is very valuable and can be used in other forms of Jewish meditation. Thus, many classical Kabbalah texts talk about Yichudim, or unification, which I discussed briefly in the previous chapter. For the most part, the meditational method Yichudim involves imaging various names of God and then manipulating the letters. In general, the method of Yichudim is highly advanced and requires some good knowledge of Kabbalah. A good introduction to the method of Yichudim involves visualizing the tetragrammaton. Anybody know what the tetragrammaton is?
The
UK Buster, very good. Right, no, tetra is the four one. This is similar to the technique of contemplating the tetragrammaton, which you described previously, but here it's done without any external aid. Significantly, an exercise that entails visualizing the tetragrammaton is mentioned in the Shulchan Aruch, the standard code of Jewish law. Where does it say that? Right at the beginning. Shiviti Hashem Lenegdi Tami. Shiviti Hashem Lenegdi Tami means I put the equivalent of God opposite me all the time. What does it mean? How do you do that? So you visualize the name of God. It is also an introduction to a number of other more advanced techniques discussed in Kabbalah. By visualizing God's name, one can attain a tremendous feeling of closeness to God. One actually feels the presence of Hashem and experiences a deep sense of awe of the present. A number of classical Jewish sources find an allusion to such visualization. In the verse which I just mentioned, I place Yudke Vavke before me at all times. This type of visualization is also useful during worship and prayer. Here too, you can have use contemplation as an introduction to visualization. If you find it difficult to visualize a tetragrammaton, spend a number of days contemplating the name written on a sheet or card. You could spend the first half of the session contemplating the written name and the other half visualizing it with eyes closed. Eventually be able to visualize it without using the card at all. Okay, then he goes into some sort of Kabbalistic stuff, which I don't want to discuss right now, about the various different letters. One letter, towards the end of the chapter, he writes, these last methods can bring a person to very high spiritual levels and should not be taken lightly. The original sources state that before attending any of these more advanced methods, one should spend the entire day in preparation, reciting the Psalms and studying the Torah. Before beginning the meditation, one should immerse oneself in a mikveh or any other natural body of water. It's not the ones we talk about. These are the ones I just skipped. To cleanse oneself both physically and spiritually. Some sources also indicate that one should dress totally in white for these advanced meditations. This type of visualization can be dangerous and should not be attempted without an experienced spiritual master or meditating partner. Baal Shem Tov recommends that one have a partner for any type of advanced meditation. Then, if necessary, one partner can bring the other back to the real world. I guess when he died, he was on his own. Visualization is valuable for another reason. In deeper forms of meditation, one sees visions. As discussed earlier, these visions should not be taken too seriously. Unless a person is very advanced and working under the tutelage of an experienced master, these visions are almost certain to be spurious. That means false. It is therefore recommended that when any visions appear, they be banished from the mind. If one learns to control one's visualizations, then this is fairly easy. Some sources recommend that the visualizations, when they occur, should be banished from the mind and replaced with the tetragrammaton. When one learns how to control the imagery in the mind's eye, there is much less danger that spurious visions will appear. One's meditation is then pure and undisturbed by low-level effects. The implication, of course, is that is at that point one can accomplish nevuah. So as I said before, visualization at that point are forms of prophecy. So as I said before, he applies this to davening, and so maybe we'll go through it a little bit later. But I wanted Alex to speak to you about visualization. Do you want me to leave or help if I leave?
Yesterday you asked who had problems with visualization. Like maybe nobody has problems with visualization. Anybody has problems with visualization? Okay. So this can make
a one-on-one outside.
The idea is like that. That basically, in order to function well, not to talk to people, to remember your parents, to remember everything, you need to do visualization. Let's say if you just pay attention close to like your internal thing. What's going on now? Shalom Aleichem, Malachem Shalom. What do you see in your mind?
Words.
It's your words. Okay. So words are not real. So you visualize them, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, you already have some stuff. Probably somebody saw Shabbat table, right? Yeah. Which also is visualization. So if you can see this word, if I
put down here,
ideas to make visualize Aleph or Yud-K, what do we do? Otherwise, it's not here anymore. It's only here in our mind. So basically, you can't do this visualization already, right? So now you just need to have it to change to hey.
Any questions? How do you see pictures?
able to visualize the picture.
But you could see this, and you could see words, right?
Words you could see, that's easier to see.
Let's say, if I say cat and dog, what's the difference between them?
The guy was sitting here before.
Huh?
The guy left was sitting here.
So, oh, good example. Who was sitting here before?
Right, I remember.
So you see picture, right? You can see words.
That's it.
I can talk for a while, but just give me some goals. I can tell how to spell, how people spell, but it's not very good. I'll tell you later. If somebody wants, I'll tell you how you can start spelling stuff.
Another question. Yeah. Let's say the picture is distorted in any way.
What
is it? It's moody. It's like can have shades of different colors.
Okay.
Can you, it's not clear.
Can you come up with any picture issue?
Let's say a letter word, like olive. When I see the olive, I feel like it's, there are shades. They're like it's been isolated in its own world, but yeah, there are different things going on. You know what I mean?
You mean relative to shades, how good you can visualize things. I'm not so good, I can't do it. So, okay, if you see it now, can you imagine you're standing like sort of screen, monitor in front of you, maybe TV? And you can adjust it. Like, you can make it clear or less clear. Can you make it less clear to make it more fuzzy?
Well, make it...
Like, more mushy, more, like, make it less. Make it
the
less.
The only way I can see it better is I visualize it closer.
Okay, if you...
But the problem is, still, let's say you would draw it on the board.
Yeah.
Let's say you draw the out, right? I feel like it's been colored in a way, like on the sides.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like I can still see it, but I feel like something is happening on all the sides, you know.
And
like there's a world in itself, not the out, but something else.
Can you make it even more on that side? Like make it work. If you imagine if you have sort of control, you can
make it worse.
Yeah. Can you hold off your hand like this?
Like this?
Yeah. If you have control, you have control of TV. Make it work one way.
Okay. That's worse.
Now begin to turn it another way. Till it becomes clear now.
No, it doesn't work.
So it stops at 10 points.
It doesn't work. Once it goes worse, that doesn't get
better. How do you know it works better?
Mm-hmm.
You don't see it. How do you know that it works better?
It was better because I remember.
Sorry, it's just about class. We can talk afterwards.
No, but it's
important. Afterwards in
it's also class. Important for people to know how to visualize because the visualization can be unclear. And is it visualization or is it like memory? Like you know, like when you draw a letter A, right? Let's say you draw an A. As soon as I leave the class, I remember how I looked on the board. Or once I close my eyes and after some time passed, it might not be in my head. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And when you said it's not as clear as you want to be, right? It means that you sort of have picture you want to go. Because in order to make this comparison, you need to see this picture. If I tell you, what's the difference between Rakov and Rakishov? It's not papyrus,
right?
You need to see both in order to come to a conclusion, right? So same thing now, but if you see that it's not as smooth, it's not as clear as you want to see, really see it somewhere, right? Because otherwise it can't come, so it's
an intellectual...
That's a very important point. That's why I never understood this word.
It's not when you do this exercise in classes.
Yeah.
Some people say, my picture is not as good as his picture. Which is like, doesn't make sense. I don't know what kind of picture I'm making. I don't know what kind. Maybe your picture is much better than my picture. And you don't have it with your picture, right? So it's very subjective. But if you say it's not as good as you want it to be, it really means that you have somewhere in your mind you have a really good picture. Because you can compare.
That's because intellectually, when I see a picture on the board, that's what I want to have in my mind.
You see both, because all comparison...
When I see reality and I see my thought, I see that the reality is much better than my imagination.
So they say, okay, let's talk about it.
It's an important point which you just brought up, which is really, I never even thought of it before yesterday. I thought, and I'm reading about like Kaplan, that in order to do visualization, the way he describes it, what you have to do is you have to be able to close your eyes and see on your eyelids, so to speak, see if the Yud Kei Vav Kei or the words of the Tefillah or whatever you're trying to visualize. That's not true. That is a high level of visualization, and obviously he would like you to reach that, but everybody does visualization on a rudimentary level, even with their eyes wide open, and in the, it's not, as you said, it's not on the front on the screen, but it's somewhere like up here. But it's really also, there is some imagery, some capacity to have imagery up here instead of right in front of you. So therefore, when you are thinking about somebody else, what somebody else looks like, right? When you were, let's say, Rabbi Rakowski. So then, right now, you can visualize in your mind, even with your eyes wide open, there's somewhere in your mind, in the, an imagery center, where this is actually taking place, where you're visualizing Rabbi Rakowski, right? Because otherwise, you wouldn't be able to identify him. You have to have a stored picture of him, which you refer to, which might be fuzzy. It's not precisely what Rabbi Lubavitcher looks like you said, but it's there. So the same thing, if you actually try to visualize, let's say, I tried this yesterday during davening, actually. So if you try to visualize Yudke Vavke in front of you, it won't necessarily work, right? It seems that, obviously, he wants you to get to that level, but I don't know how you get there. But what I understand is that, yes, in my mind, just like I have a picture of my wife, or I have a picture of Alex, I have a picture of anybody that I know, especially if I've seen them recently, the longer it's been, the more fuzzier it gets, then also I can visualize the Yudke Vavke. Now, what Rabbi Kaplan said also, which is helpful, which Alex alluded to, explains to me something else also, which is very often, you find in front of a Omud, in front of a Chazan's Omud in Shul. I don't know if you ever noticed that, but I'm sure you did. In many places where the Chazan stands, there is like a Shiviti Hashem Lenegdi Tomid, right? It says Shiviti Hashem Lenegdi Tomid on a plaque, or whatever it is in front, or sometimes it has this whole, you know, Kabbalistic thing with the menorah, with, you know, with all these branches, and it's just, you know, the Sephardim very often have that. Anybody with Lamna Samikinos Miz Moshir, so they have...
Kabbalah reason why there's menorahs always in the front of the shul?
Yeah, the Kabbalistic reason.
And then there's
no shul front, No, they have a picture of a menorah with writing on it. In Sephardim Sidurim.
It's actually written on the candle, and there
right.
Part of the letters going on.
In a Spidey Zoom, they have it. We don't have a Spidey Zoom.
You read it
there.
as it's written.
Yeah, the...
You read it as it's lit.
So the Spidey should actually have a picture of how it's written, the Lamna Seya, Beginos Miz Moshir, Well, you don't have to go back and get it now. But in any event, the point is that... so now, then I realized yesterday, I always thought, what kind of stupidity is this? Well, you put this thing in front of you, it's supposed to make you, give you more kavana. It doesn't do a thing, right? I never understood what purpose of anything these things were. But then, when Alex put yesterday the Yud-K, Vav-K on the wall, on the board, which probably all of you can still, including me, remember exactly what it looked like on the board, so it makes the visualization that much easier. If you have a specific Yud-K, Vav-K in front of you, right? Because it has many different fonts and many different permutations, right? So it's not necessarily, so sometimes you remember it one way, sometimes another way, and that will not necessarily be very consistent. It could work, and maybe there are different times one to image it, imagine it in different ways, image it is a better term, in different ways, but what that plaque is supposed to do, it's supposed to give you a Yud-K, Vav-K to look at, to contemplate, and then even be able to close your eyes, or with your eyes open. Every one of us, this was a remarkable chiddush to me yesterday, I don't know, so you guys might not be a chiddush, but it was a chiddush which I looked at. Every one of us is capable of visualizing with our eyes open. You don't have to close your eyes and see it on some sort of screen inside your mind, which is in front of you, but rather it takes place within your mind. I don't know if that's a revelation to anybody. So that actually makes it easier to do. Yes.
He tracks it very well. Only one problem that I have in his description, he puts down this like very unbelievable fast, nobody can do it. Everything else he describes it perfectly. Only he says it's a nobody that few people he hidden can do it. So it's only one can say the same.
I don't know. I'm not sure whether the stuff with the white cloth and the black cloth sounds more difficult to me.
Otherwise your hands would not go like this, it would stay like that, right? Or somehow else. But in order to understand this idea to see a black fire, white fire, or oven.
Yeah,
black,
no,
fire.
Black fire, white fire, yeah.
Yeah, so you need to see it, because otherwise you would not understand what he means. Let's say if I tell you, черный огонь на белом огне. Did you understand what I said?
No clue.
Yeah, I said in Russian, black fire, white fire. Why did you understand? Because this voice in Russian does not trigger pictures. When I say it in English, it triggers my pictures in your mind. So in order to make sense from the sentences, you need to see this picture.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I said in Russian, it didn't bring a picture. Only difference, because when I say in English, you have voice.
But so therefore, if in your experience you haven't ever experienced black fire on white fire, how are you supposed to visualize it? Isn't that much more difficult? Because then you have to create an image in your mind which you have not previously experienced.
Right, and you do it all the time. Let's say you're going to an appointment to Manhattan to see someone, right? Job interview, whatever it is. Probably you have some ideas how it's going to be, right? And you never had such experience. You never saw this person. Let's say you talk on the phone someone you never saw. And you need to see him. Or let's say, I told you that I went to this beautiful island. And you never saw this island, but if I describe it, your mind has the ability to draw this picture. Because you saw islands, you saw green trees, and you put them together. So, you saw fire, you saw letters, you could put them together. Because if you could not do it, you would not be able to plan your future. But when you start to do something with it, you start to write your articles, or you start to write your book, you sort of see how it's going to, what's going to be in the end, right? You have some ideas. Maybe it's not correct, maybe something else is going to happen. But you know to plan, to think about the future, or to buy a house and to think how this house is going to look like, you need to come up with something which is not real in this world. It has to be real because you have I, A, B, and you put them together. You saw trees, you saw islands, you saw ocean, and when I talk about islands, you put them together. So you saw fire, you saw black, you know what's white, you know what letter looks like, so you can put them together. I talk now, you need to do it, not understand what I'm talking about. Because otherwise, you think, what I'm talking about is I said, look, черный огонь на белом. It doesn't make sense. So.
Okay. Sounds easy. You're right, obviously that's a good point, that you can have it, people do have ideas of things from their prior experience for which they construct future events or meet people they're going to meet.
But how people have phobias? Somebody has phobia of flying. He's driving in airport and he sees pictures of plane collapsing and all these things that he comes up with all this. It's going to go very fast and unconscious well. And when he sees all these pictures, he gets scared, not real pictures. Right? Or somebody's very excited about public speaking because he didn't start talking, but he sees people are smiling, enjoying his talk. And somebody sees in his mind people who are angry, and talking about, and he's scared.
Are people in the room?
Yeah. So, you can make any pictures, and you can be happy about all those pictures, and can you be upset? Depends on your attitude to life. So, if you change the pictures, you can be more happy. Before you start talking, you can see people smiling, they're laughing, they're recording, they're themselves. Not. Or you can see people leaving your class, and you can be upset about what they did not take place yet. So,
Okay.
So what's today's topic about?
What? It makes it much easier than Rabbi Kaplan sounds and makes it out to be, which I think is right. It's not so difficult to do as long as you don't have the expectation of being able to see something on a screen in front of you. Am I correct about that? That's a more difficult thing?
But when you said to see a screen in front, your hands went like that. Probably it's not a screen in front, right? It's not like your hands are so like this, right? Why you have
that? I get it trapped here. but I can't see anything on my hands. That's not true.
Not as good as you can see your hands, right? But when I went to a Shabbos, you saw all this exercise, of Hashem, right? You were showing
what
hair. Exercise,
yeah.
You need to see how to describe it in your mind. Otherwise, you would not be able to describe it. So it's my point that I cannot see as good as on screen. You need to see the screen. Because it's interesting to think about like one of the biggest failures in terms of communication because people say, no, like, I can't see, I don't do something. But things like do not have sense only in language. If they ask you, don't think about like cat is chasing a dog. You need to see it, not to understand. Right? If parents say to a kid, don't steal milk, kids see pictures of stealing milk. Because you can't see pictures not stealing milk without thinking steal milk. Or don't fail, or don't do this, don't do that. or I don't want to be angry. In order to make sense from phrase, don't be angry, you need to have some sense of being angry, a little bit. Not like full type, but don't be angry, like, because if I tell you something that you've never experienced, but then don't be blue. I mentioned some words in Russian. You don't have internal experience, right? What is blue? I don't know what it is. So, in order to say, don't do, I cannot see the screen, you need to see the screen. Perhaps it's not as clear as you can. If it would be as clear, it would be very hard to live. Because it's not completely the same. It's very good for us. Because if it would be the same, you would not find even this on your real house and house that you want to have. I'll tell you what. Some people who have psychological sicknesses, they don't have the strategy of reality. Kids need to develop. Small kids, sometimes they lie. Because they, for them, things that they make up is as real as things that's real. At some age, maybe 3-4 years old, maybe probably young, old, I'm not sure. So, we develop strategy for reality. Probably for my first strategy was, if it's a little bit mushy, it's not real. Because if it was as real as it is, if I say, can you imagine Rabbi Shaw here? Probably all of you can imagine him full size, Rabbi Shaw, he's 10 inches, has his black collar. If it would be as real as little Rabbi Shaw, you would begin to talk to him and you would decide that you're crazy. You need to have strategies to have him real. What's real? When you said about the screen, I'm sure you saw the screen in your mind. Of course, it wasn't as real as the screen of your computer in your room. But if there would be exactly same, like, same size, same level, same type of sharpness, right? Like, if you would start something on your computer right here, but it was not here real. So we need to have some sense of understanding what's real, what's not real. It's very good that we have. Otherwise, like, you could talk to our show here, and you could talk to your wife right here, say, what are you doing?
So there are actually people who suffer from such a...
I don't know how many people, but I've heard that some people, I know someone thought, one guy who had emotional sickness, he taught him to have strategy for, and everybody has different strategies. But if you just mentioned your strategy for fast, in order for you to do something in fast, it just becomes, as you mentioned, funny, right? You said funny. It's your strategy to start experience fast, which is in fast and some fast. If you would know the strategy, I would ask you, what did you do yesterday and 5 years ago? And you would say, I don't know what's different. But for you, what you did yesterday, it was less funny than what it was from 5 years ago. It's your strategy. And somebody would say, that something was yesterday is colorful, and somebody was 20 years ago. It's more like black and white. Some people are thinking about it.
What is saying also happens on the collective capacity of early Iron Age Akkadians had a different way of ordering things collectively in mind, of sequential things of time, and different ways of visualizing things. If we visualize things based on the world that we have, and we're modernists or whatever, and we're not from shoes or whatever, we have a very different way of visualizing, say, something that's a tree. We may think of something that's a tree in a planter, not something that is an independently growing tree in a forest, because we don't see things as forests. When I say meat, you know, someone who's in a farm visualizes a cow, visualizes a whole different set. It's an ecosystemic thing versus something that's wrapped up in plastic in a package.
Right.
There's very different consequences in a lot of different
ways. This kind of experience for past and future. That if you use 5 years, but in movies, sometimes when they become memories, they use black and white, right? Yeah. Somebody like a colorful movie, modern movie, somebody's like his memory from his childhood, they use more black and white. Yes. And sometimes they don't make them 5 years. For you, it would be better probably if the movie would be designed to make it 5 years. But for a lot of people, black and white shows are basically the past. Somebody, just a very smart guy, he picks up this unconscious idea that people thought past and future. It's also location. When I talk about past and future, perhaps you notice my hands go like this. Because for me, future would be then, past and there.
It's a spatial distinction.
Very colorful distinction, spatial distinction. And you can make all types of funny things with this. So you can, really, I really love this stuff. So we learn 2 days, we learn in five weeks more.
Okay. See, I like the shiurim more when I learn something as opposed to when I teach something. Yes, I appreciate that. I don't even know what I was talking
about.
I'm not sure what signifies that. That's why I have my hands behind my back right now.
Gesture is part of this. Blind people gesture. people that are blind from birth, gestures, the way they orient things like this, the way they visualize things. They have visual proportion and distinction in their mind. Rabbi Avi Shaffer has an article, you can find it for the rabbi, where he discusses something in Scientific American about visualization, and that blind people have ways of structuring geometry as they learn it, that indicate that on the level the brain functions a certain way. When we visualize things, we use a different part of the brain. Say when we're reading, and people who are speed reading order things in their brain in a way, in a part of the brain, or part of the training is that they visualize it more than they simply have the narrative in some different structure in their brain. So it goes from being, say, in this format to being changed to a whole other format when it's stored in the brain. So they're encouraged to do that. It's a more efficient way of storing things. But the consequence is that someone can really visualize, say, War and Peace, or they're reading Johnny Got It, or they're reading something of a totally different nature. We're in the visualization for when that really puts someone on a different edge. And when one's reading, one's read, and one's reading things that are to be collected, that are collectively established by Nebim and by the last Sanhedrin, of these, this is the way. This is the way that you, this is the way one makes these proper connections within the halakhic system, within the Jewish rubric, of the way that we visualize the world. And these are the things that are of importance.
That's interesting, but he just mentioned Johnny Got His Gun is a very anti-war book, right? It's a book which I...
If you don't like war, I guess.
Yeah. As far as I remember, when I started reading that, which just indicates to me that I do have a capacity to visualize things, because when they read that book in one English class, which I was in high school, I asked to be switched out of the English class.
Precisely.
I couldn't take that book. So it was impossible for me to read.
And that's the reason we don't look at the magazine rack when we go to 7-Eleven, because we will be filled with images of Britney doing what have you and various kinds of things. These things are uploaded in our brains whether we like it or not. And those are visual
that's
images.
Unless you grow up around with that cover.
Versus a narrative society. Versus reading versus one where they're illiterati, where the reading is not an essential way of ingraining things into the mind into the and our place in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Textual versus pretextual. Establishing something that comes from revelation as something that is written down, a text that is given to us, versus simple statements that are given in an oral capacity to us. Being told of having a visual, how to have a visualization,
mm-hmm.
versus reading how one has a visualization.
Right. Obviously, there's a difference, yeah.
Since we got on
this topic today, so I wanted, before I go back to Modim, which we'll do next week, so I want to read you a couple of very interesting things which he said about davening. First of all, he says about davening, he says, this is something you referred to yesterday, is Yosef with him? So you said that about the 3 hours before, 3 hours after, the hour before, hour after, and the hour for the Shemona Esrei. So here he said, these methods, he says a few things, he says, bowing is the table of putting oneself in the meditative mood. Meditative state. According to the Talmud, one bows down very quickly, but then comes up very slowly like a snake. We explained that before. The commentators explain that this means raising first the head and then the rest of the body. When one comes up in this manner, it slows the body's tempo and puts the mind into a quieter framework. It is thus has the effect of quieting the mind and making it more receptive for meditation. With the exception of bowing, it is preferable to remain absolutely motionless during the Amida. Some people have the habit of shaking and swaying during this prayer, but the codes of Jewish law regard this more as a nervous habit than as a means of improving one's concentration. Both the Kabbalists and many major codifiers, halachic authorities, explain that all motion should be avoided in Amida. If you find it possible to remain absolutely still, you may sway very lightly, but excessive shaking or swaying tends to impair concentration in the meditative sense. It is also important to close the eyes in Amida, especially during the first blessing, in order to get yourself into a meditative state. If you do not know the rest of the Amida by heart, it can be said from the prayer book. The words of the Amida should be said quietly, either in a very soft voice or in a quiet whisper. The voice should be directed inward rather than outward. These methods will make the Amida a more effective instrument of worship. If the Amida is also to be a meditation, there is one more important condition, and this has to do with the pace at which the words are said. The Talmud relates that the original saints, Chassidim Rishonim, used to take 1 hour to recite the Amida. from the context, as well as from a number of Kabbalistic sources, it is obvious that these original saints used aminos in meditation. This teaching provides an important clue to the pace at which the amida is to be said if it is to be used as a meditative device. A simple count shows that the entire amida contains approximately 500 words. The original saints took an hour to say it, or some 3,600 seconds. Therefore, they said this prayer at a pace of approximately one word every 7 seconds. And it's interesting, the Baal Shem Tov actually says, if you're having difficulty in Kavana, in Shmona Esrei, then you should extend the saying of the word. So he says, don't say the word briefly and go on to the next one. Baruch Atah Hashem, you say, Baruch Atah, and so on and so forth. And you say, you extend the same word, and he says that that will give you more Kavana. So he doesn't explain really why, but this is an explanation. So he says, to say the Amida at this pace is a highly advanced form of meditation. However, this pace is not difficult to maintain for the first paragraph, which is the most important. Since the blessing contains 42 words, to say it at the rate of a word every 7 seconds would take just under 5 minutes. This is a reasonable time. Most of us finish our Shmoneh Esrei well within 5 minutes.
2 minutes 40 seconds. Good. Improving.
What?
They won't let you be the Shliach Tzibur.
Okay, so don't do the Shliach Tzibur. So the first blessing contains 42 words to say at the rate of a word every 7 seconds will take just under 5 minutes. This is a reasonable time. You have long enough to put one into a deep meditative state. So this pace has the effect of quieting the mind in the most profound manner. It is the meditative state appears subjectively to be very different than that obtained through ordinary mantra meditation or contemplation, because the words one is saying define the meditation at every point. And then he says, while reciting a word, and for the period afterward, in other words, so about 7 seconds, do not think of anything other than the simple meaning of the word. And he discusses the significance of the words in a different chapter. Allow the words to penetrate your inner being, opening yourself to feel and see the meaning of each word. During the pause between words, the mind is hushed in anticipation of the next word, and then cleared of all other thoughts. Eventually, he says, once you visualize, like I mentioned yesterday, some people find it beneficial to combine the amida with a visualization technique. Some sources indicate that while reciting the first paragraph, one should attempt to visualize pure white light. Other sources state that one should visualize the letters of the tetragrammaton. So another source teaches that it's beneficial to visualize nothingness. There's a whole chapter on visualizing nothingness. That's why I was saying this paragraph.
He did that.
He said it's very difficult.
He was going to do something. Nothing.
So that's one of the more dangerous things he speaks about. The person who's familiar with these techniques may find it beneficial in having the meditative experience of the Amida. Another alternative is constant and spontaneous images that arise in the mind's eye. Eventually, however, one learns that the most powerful technique of all is to use the words of the Amida and nothing else. When the words will the mind, one becomes oblivious to all other thoughts. The words draw the person to God, and the mind becomes completely filled with the divine. In this manner, the Amida can bring a person to some of the most profound spiritual experiences possible. Since it was composed for this purpose, it is by no means surprising. So that's what he said yesterday. This is not how a litva was happening to God. Obviously, this is a very powerful emotional experience, and it has actually a very important. It unites a person with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the ideal of Godhead, to unite a person with Hashem. Okay, technically speaking, officially speaking, we're supposed to be doing modim. So we will get back to doing modim with Hashem on Monday.
Now, Rabbi, you were saying, because I remember people telling me, like, going, bowing back and forth.